Good afternoon, and welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. Today we take you to Hauck Auditorium at the University of Maine in Orono for the 2014 Senator George J. Mitchell Lecture on Sustainability. The keynote speaker is William Clark, the Harvey Brooks Professor of International Science, Public Policy, and Human Development at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Professor Clark's research focuses on sustainability science, understanding the interactions of human and environmental systems with a view toward advancing the goals of sustainable development. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time and will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at your convenience or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is David Hart, Director of the Mitchell Center. Following the keynote speaker will be remarks by Senator George Mitchell.
It's now a great pleasure to welcome Professor Bill Clark to the University of Maine and to thank him for being with us to present this year's Senator George J. Mitchell Lecture on Sustainability. Bill is here to help illuminate the road ahead. Please join me in welcoming Bill Clark.
So, thank you very much, David, President Hunter, Senator Mitchell, for both the honor and the opportunity to present the Senator George J. Mitchell Lecture on Sustainability. As a teacher in a school of government, I'm also particularly glad, not to say awed, by the opportunity to be giving a lecture here in Maine, a state that, for reasons I still don't understand, has done far more than its share to give government a good name in the United States. I grew up in a household of whose one comment as a politician I, as a kid, should pay attention to was Margaret Chase Smith, who, despite their own personal political leanings, was always their great hero for a person who knew the difference between position and fundamental values and expressed them courageously. As a college student, struggling with my interest in environmental science on the one hand, but my interest in changing the world on the other, Senator Ed Muskie, who appeared across my bows in a number of different fortuitous circumstances, showed that there were people coming from the other side, not my side of science, but the side of changing the world, who paid attention to science, who were interested in hearing about what we had to say, pushing us on its relevance to real people running real businesses, real jobs, having real grandchildren, and so on, lessons for which I will be forever grateful. And then as a young professional, I found myself trying to patch together how it could be that climate change and acid rain and biodiversity change and so on were somehow tangled together environmentally, only to come across Senator Mitchell's then new book, The World on Fire, in which it was abundantly clear that at least this politician was way out ahead of us in the science community in seeing the connections among these different features, ways in which we as humans were not picking out one problem at a time, but were doing things which were changing in an integrated, if David will, systems way, the challenges we were all facing. I'm grateful to all of them. I do realize that there are other distinguished politicians active even today in Maine, but given how close we are to an election, I will stop talking about them. So, that said, the real reason I'm actually here to talk about this subject reflects less on Maine's leading politicians and more on their leading pest, particularly the spruce budworm. Now, why? As a graduate student back in the mid-1970s, I found myself just across the border in New Brunswick, part of the army of scientists and forest managers and concerned citizens and politicians, struggling to sustain the well-being of a society intimately bound up with its natural sources, natural resource base, in front of one of its recurrent outbreaks of an insect that wanted to use the forest too, but in different ways than people did. My role in this battle as a mere graduate student was a minor one, but it took me on the beginning steps of the journey that brings me here today. I moved slowly, too slowly, from being somebody saying, the interesting thing here is what's causing this outbreak, to saying, no, the interesting thing here is why those wretched scientists in Maine are sowing confusion to us Canadians by measuring things with silly units like miles and Fahrenheit and bugs per square foot, which, you know, as the junior guy on the team, my whole job, I thought some days, was just translating those into English, Canadian English. To why won't those politicians listen to us experts who think we understand this situation? To slowly understanding that the problem was also partly, why are we experts who understand all things known to heaven and earth about budworms, not actually studying the stuff that the forest managers, the people running paper companies, the people trying to keep the employment rate up, needed to know in order to sustain their lives in the front of this pest. And finally, into an uneasy collaboration that led to a shared understanding of what needed to be managed was not the insect, but the forest. And what we needed to do it was not my research on insect dispersal or a fleet of old World War II bombers carrying DDT, but rather a change in the New Brunswick's Crown Lands Act, which gave the state an uneasy and unenthusiastically received ability to intervene and ask property owners to do forest thinning and forest management that would substitute for loss of jobs on the one hand or tons of DDT spraying on the other to control this beast. Now, obviously from what is in your newspapers and the website of your forest department today, we did not solve the budworm problem. But we did give me a supreme education in the difference between studying what's most interesting scientifically and grappling with trying to discover what things that a scientist might contribute would most help people get on with their lives, their well-being, and ensuring the lives of their kids. It was, in short, a specific step on the route to the subject of this lecture, which is, what have we learned around the world about the general problem of mobilizing science and technology to help people develop their own lives and that of their kids sustainably into the future? And as my point of departure, I'll simply assert that, at least in my travels around the world, two things are true. One, there are oodles of scholars, young people in universities, inventors off in garages, humanists writing about human-environment interactions and so on, who desperately, urgently want the stuff they know or are learning to help people craft better lives for themselves, to support good policymaking and corporate decision-making. At the same time, around the world, there are practitioners in business, in government, in community work, who very much want the contribution, want to talk more with scientists and engineers to get to understand how they see the world rather than simply seeing it in terms of ideology and self-interest. There's a lovely article up on the center's webpage about student work here, actually documenting that legislators would prefer to get more of their information from scientists, not some of them I know, but more of their information from scientists than from the newspapers, but they can't seem to make the connection. So the desire is there, both to receive more science and technical knowledge and to make that knowledge useful to people. And sometimes it works, but too often it doesn't. We pile up reams and reams of unread reports, books, treatises. We pile up even more piles of people trying to move development forward on the front lines of business, community action, and governance, not supported by the kind of knowledge and analysis that they think they most need. So can't we do better at that, about meeting supply and demand, bringing these two sides together? The good news, of course, is that despite the many failures and the piling up, you know, unused research and so on, we also have a modicum of successes. We have things we can learn from. Now, that can be the vernal pools work that I just read about from the Center for Sustainable Solutions here. It can be Senator Mitchell's work on the Clean Air Act, which used more science than we even had at the time to move forward a truly miraculous legislative agenda. Where are you now? please. Internationally, it can be things like the Green Revolution agricultural institutes that simply brought a stampede of publicly minded scientists, plant breeders, and so on from all around the world to try to create crops that poor people needed to improve their lives. So I've been working with colleagues at the National Academy of Sciences over the past dozen years or so, trying to collect these successful examples of mobilizing science to really advance people's ability to shape the futures they want for themselves and their kids, and trying to extract from those some lessons as to, you know, it isn't a cookbook, it isn't that we know how to do this, but some properties that relatively successful efforts seem to share broadly, and therefore perhaps form a foundation on which any of us could base our next effort in our own community, in our own business, in our own governance circles, to move on to the next step without making all of the mistakes of the past for ourselves. And I'll summarize those in four big deliveries in the course of this lecture. But before I begin, I simply want to be clear. Most of this is going to seem old hat to most of you who are older than 20. That it's not that if you actually do this stuff as a major part of your life, you don't sort of get it eventually, as Senator Mitchell was remarking over lunch. It's not that you read the right book on becoming a great negotiator. It's that you're a bad negotiator, and then you get to be a little bit better negotiator. And if you don't bail out of the field, you eventually become a pretty good negotiator. That said, we all know things like how you connect knowledge with action, but we sure don't do a very good job of codifying it, of training our graduate students in it, of teaching our freshmen as they come in, all set to change the world, that here are some mistakes you don't necessarily have to make all of for yourself, but there are some ways forward. That is, there is some accumulating wisdom here. So my challenge is back to you to say, make this the beginning of a conversation, not the end, of how we take some of this common sense accumulated wisdom that has bubbled up from thousands of experiments, most of them failures, some of them successes, and turn it into something that we are passing on in our classrooms, in our laboratories, in our corporations, so that more people are building on top of it, so that we don't find ourselves falling into the same pits along the way. All right, so moving from preamble to doing it. Start off a little bit with the notion of, before we worry about how you make it, what would influential knowledge anyway be? I mean, for knowledge, I'm going to mean everything from the craft skill of how to be a good fisherman to the technical knowledge of what your sensor tells you where the fish are today, to the knowledge embodied in the boat you run and the equipment you've got and so on. So it's this whole thing of formal, informal stuff from laboratories and so on and so on. Influential knowledge is harder. Now, there is some. I've been involved in efforts to get new harvest rules for budworm, of new ways of doing rice cultivation in low water, high human capacity areas, new cook stoves to limit deaths from indoor air pollution, even new Ebola vaccines. But I don't want to tell you so much about my cases as invite you to pause for just a minute and think of a really tough case in your own experience, one in which either as a potential user of technical information you found it difficult to get it from people who ought to have it, or as a researcher, somebody who's discovered stuff or knows about things that you just cannot imagine why is not being picked up in practice by people in business, government, and so on. Think of a real case and use that as the reference point for making sense of, critiquing, or asking what you would add to the points that come. Only by doing that and making this your own am I going to make any sense at all. I think the stand and deliver line for me as an often purveyor of, let me show you this new harvesting technology or this new fact about how to mess up budworms' ability to smell each other or something, is the following question. Why on earth would a person I don't know possibly trust my new knowledge or widget enough to change their behavior, especially when the health of their families, the survival of their business, their political career might well be on the line as a result of their change in behavior. And they know, as Senator Mitchell was pointing out in a meeting earlier today, at the end of the day, I'm going home, and they're not. They're going to live the problem. So what is it that would make this new widget or idea I'm offering to them, something that they would trust enough to bet their very lives on it? This is a hard question. I'm not sure any of us know the answer, but in some pretty serious digging, I think what we've come up is in most cases, such information, the widget I'm offering, needs to meet three criteria, not just one. Credibility, believability is the one that certainly any of us raised in the university framework recognize. It has to have gotten through peer review. It has to have been tested. FDA has to have recognized that it's effective and safe. And that surely matters. What we've discovered, though, is that by and large, that is not enough to get people to bet their lives and their kids on new knowledge. The new knowledge also has to be speaking to intensely felt needs that they have. You actually have to have figured out what their problem is rather than your problem. And it has to be legitimate in the sense, or fair, in the sense that they believe not only do you know what you're talking about, and you've listened hard to their problem, but you're not actually shilling for somebody else. You're not on someone else's side, dressing up an argument that they should change what they do simply to advance someone else's agenda, even as you masquerade as a scientist. And we've called this the saliency, credibility, legitimacy trilogy. And way to think about it is, I do some work in the developing world, so imagine that you're a village and you see on the other side of the river a community is actually built up, has some purchasing power, and if you could only get your agricultural goods over there, you would actually make a little bit of spare income. So you call in an expert, Bob Cates, for instance, and studies it, said, what should we do? And Cates finally says, you should build a bridge. And it's a bridge like this, and you can construct it this way, and trust me, it will stand up and it won't wash away, and that's the best thing for you to do. So the first thing you do is say, well, does this guy know anything about building bridges? And you ask around, and he's built other bridges before, and they haven't washed out in the first spring flood, so this is okay. Was he addressing your problem? Yeah, because this would actually be a way to get your goods across the river really quickly, where they would get a good market price in the village. So he's hit credibility and he's hit saliency. And you're just about to sign on the dotted line and give him his huge consulting fee when you discover that his non-existent brother-in-law sells bridges for a living. Now, it's interesting. This doesn't mean he doesn't know how to build bridges. It doesn't mean that he's not solving your problem. But your willingness to bet the bank, I think for most of us, just went down considerably because it's not clear whether he's solving his brother-in-law's problem or yours. And I think one of the hardest lessons, certainly for me as a techie to learn, is that virtually anything we do in this sustainable development arena as technical knowledge producers is born political. It's trying to get people to change from doing one thing or another, and so it is not at all unreasonable that the people we're talking to should distrust us, should wonder whose side we're really on, and should demand of us some record of past accomplishment, demonstration of good faith, and so on, that bring us into the game. So, for me, the thing we're trying to produce is influential knowledge that is not only salient or relevant to the needs of the people we're trying to help, rather than our own visions of what they should want. It's credible not just to us, but to them by criteria they care about. And it has demonstrated some degree of legitimacy or fairness or regard to their own justified suspicions that we're actually working for someone else. So how do we accomplish that? Four sets of things that I think have bubbled up as fairly effective a good bit of the time. The first is that efforts to mobilize knowledge for sustainable development in ways that are influential almost always turn out to be strongly collaborative exercises. So what's the problem here? The problem is that too often the alternative is mutual incomprehension. The scientists and technical people don't really understand what the fishermen or the foresters or the family worried about health effects of insecticide spraying
really haven't taken the trouble to find out what their concerns and hopes and fears are about. Similarly, the people on the action line really don't know what the scientists and engineers have to offer or are talking about. And that non-dialogue can go on forever with very bad effects. We've seen it in the huge amount invested in cook stoves around the world over the last 10 years. Indoor air pollution from cook stoves kills huge numbers of kids, mostly kids and women. Sensible people have come in to design more efficient cook stoves and gotten them to burn cleaner and so on, without ever figuring out how many things people in much of the developing world use cook stoves for. One of them is to deliver the right heat to cook the foods they cook, rather than just any heat. One is often to use the smoke to kill off things scurrying around in the rafters that you don't want scurrying around. And on and on and on. My most ignominious encounter with this was working in a village in Kenya that I'd just come into and was looking at their windows, which, as some of you know, there are really, really small. I said, well, you know, why don't you build bigger windows? Because the smoke would go out. And they just turned to me with this pitying, kind look and said, yes, but the leopards would come in. I was not solving their problem. I was solving my problem. And we can do this. Neglected crops, 50% of the world's food comes from three crops. There are 12,000 crops or so out there that might have R&D put into them to work better, to deliver a nutritious, drought-resistant, food under lots of circumstances. We don't do it because we're not listening to people's needs on the ground. Obvious, sure. But like I'm sure several of you, I was struck by an article in the New York Times a few weeks back that was heralding this wonderful new innovation laboratory at one of our more prestigious technical universities that will remain nameless since someone's taping this, which trumpeted the amazing fact that when they had gotten their engineers to actually go out into the community and talk to the people whose problems they were trying to solve, rather than solve them from their benches in the school, imagining what those problems were, not only did they get more solutions, but they got the students vastly more interested in what was going on. This is an elite teaching university. Surprise. So what do? The prescription is, of course, to get away from old models of one-way technology transfer. We know the problem. We know the answer. Just do what we tell you. Getting away from approaches to science communication, sorry, my lunch companions, which really amount to yelling louder and using simpler words to convey exactly the same one-directional message. Learning to listen instead of to talk. Collaborative efforts, in short, in which producers of knowledge and users of knowledge learn to listen to one another, talk back and forth, negotiating not only what the problem is, but what kind of evidence would make sense to you, what would you find convincing, and crucially, who gets to make the choice and recommendation at the end of the day. We've had many examples. The one I saw here looking at these accomplishments in Maine of late is this Maine Futures Community Mapper, which seems to have engaged every imaginable interest group in the state in beginning to build some shared visions of alternative futures for Maine. I've been involved in things like it in Africa. They're really impressive. The challenge is how scholars and practitioners can collaborate in doing this sort of stuff more often, of not making it news that a modern technical university has just discovered that this might actually be a better way of doing things than sitting in a new iLab, shiny iLab, imagining what audiences needed from them in order to make their next zigabuck. Okay, so second, called the systems enterprise. Mobilizing knowledge for sustainable development, I would argue, does need a systems perspective. Otherwise, I'm not living up to David's introduction. Why? Because the way we as a techie community, unless we work for a really big vertically organized firm, tend to be fragmenters. The image I've used sometimes is, imagine that you wanted to invent the first automobile. And you assigned the job not to Henry Ford or J.E. Pierce or whoever, but to a university. and each professor got to work on the part of the imagined automobile that they found most interesting. And you'd get this really cool transmission and probably a really strong piston or two. Almost inconceivable anyone would invent a tire or a drivetrain. And at the end of the day, you would have a pile of really, really neat inventions and signaling technologies and probably anti-collision devices using radar. But there would be no possible way this stuff would come together to generate a piece of transportation. And why? Because all the professors would have said, I don't want to do that, the transmission. I want to do this thing that's really cool and interesting. That's why you become a professor, is because you don't want to take orders from people. And so we're left with automobiles that look like they were built by professors, vaccines that have billions of dollars put into them but demand a cold chain to preserve them and make them use, which doesn't exist in all the parts of the world that they would be using it. Household solar energy getting a huge push without the smart grids that would make it actually usable as part of a national energy strategy. NASA investing gigadollars in satellite sensing technologies and almost nothing in the downloading capacity and information processing that would make that useful to people around the world. So the prescription, appallingly for universities, is what business would call project management. You don't commission people to build the part of the car they want. You organize a project to build a car. And you'll know when it's delivered because somebody can drive from point A to point B in an affordable way. And you order, cajole, induce, incentivize, tell them you'll give them tenure to the folks you want to work on the essential but mundane parts of that technology. This is not commonly the way universities are organized. Decreasingly, it's even the way business research laboratories are organized, which is perhaps even more distressing. It is why it is interesting to see Maine so far out front introducing a solution center. And I think the superb challenge of that is going to be how well you can assemble and sustain teams that are doing not only the really interesting stuff, but the mundane connectivity. Now, it can be done. The Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and Malaria that has been working in the health sector over the last decade came pretty close to pulling this off in that arena with a huge set of increases in what we're delivering on the ground. In the United States, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, whose administrator you had here last year, did this utterly brilliant set of things that, having discovered that they just had the new computers that would let computers and sensor arrays that would let you do an 18-month ahead forecast of when one of these El Nino type events was very likely to change your rainfall and storminess, that they recognized, unlike many before them, that if they simply stopped there and improved the next 2 or 3 or 5% in the prediction capacity of these just astounding sets of data arrays and computers, it would only be good, useful to a tiny fraction of very wealthy corporations and countries. So what NOAA managed to do, I still would love to know the story of how they did it, was establish around the United States and abroad a set of bridging institutions whose entire job was to go out and find people who could potentially benefit from that information. Whether they were farmers or people responsible for managing water supplies or snowmelt pack and so on and so on, and build the connecting tissue between the kind of decision tools those people used and the kind of outputs that these snazzy new climatological computer models would generate. And that often ended up building institutions of 10 or 20 people, building local trust relationships, an absolutely fabulous accomplishment, showing what can be done when you take solving the problem rather than just doing the neat science as the guideline. So moving ahead, thinking of the really hard problem you promised me you would be thinking of, I think the question is how we, on the research side, bridge this always false dichotomy between basic research is what smart people do and applied research is what the rest do, and understand that some of the greatest scientists and scholars in history, Louis Pasteur, the most notable, have made their careers precisely by moving fluidly back and forth between talking with milkmaids and veterinarians in the morning and discovering the germ theory of disease back in their laboratory in the afternoon. We universities are among the worst offenders, along with our funding sources, in keeping that dichotomy there, which has neither historical nor instrumental roots and excuses to it. How can we, therefore, fund, staff, and reward performance in the kinds of institutions, whether in academia or in the public sector or even in government laboratories, that integrate those two ends of cutting-edge research and intimate engagement with practice on the ground to produce solutions, that is, real cars rather than just neat parts, a systems enterprise. Third piece is doing this job right turns out to be an adaptive enterprise. As was stressed in my introduction, I think one of the things any of us have worked in the world, so if I said this wouldn't be news to you, is that we're not very good at predicting what's going to happen when we throw a new technology or a new policy into play in the world. They never work out the way they were supposed to. That's not to say we shouldn't do them or we shouldn't try to do forward assessments and views. It says that we just don't get it right. And therefore, the systems we design have to be ones not that are built around getting answers, but ones that are built around helping us to learn faster and faster what works, what would have to be adjusted, what gets thrown out, and so on. And we do a bunch of things that are just backwards from that. Part of it is risk aversion, a very individual psychology-grounded stuff, but one we then enforce in most of our institutions, which says only do the safe stuff, guarantee success. A colleague of mine working in a good industrial research lab said that he would have fired any teams in his group that had success rates of higher than 30% in the technology development they did. For those of you in academia, any of you who have a less than 30% success rate in your NSF research, who's going to tell NSF? I mean, this is not what we reward. This is not what you would brag about in your promotion regime. I will dare say even this is not what you brag about on the floor of the Senate, telling people how many bills you have put forward that have tanked because you didn't get it right. It's also a matter of hubris. So we don't take risks. The things we do, we just dig in and insist that they must have been successes and will ought to persist forever. And obviously, a current main example is in which you're out actually ahead of the rest of us, is discovering that many of these dams that we put in place in an earlier era to do perfectly good things would have been better if they had had an instruction manual for taking them apart, a drain attached, and any number of things that said the fact that a dam is a good thing now and here doesn't mean it will always be one. As we think forward with big new energy technology systems, to pay more attention to the ones we might want to decommission and take apart someday, and the ones we wouldn't, and which score better on those grounds, not just on the grounds of 2% better on the kilowatt hour costs. And to recognize finally that I'm grading into my last topic, but that often what we face in this world of trying to get information to policymakers and decision makers in a useful way is a world which many natural scientists and engineers find hard to imagine, but one in which people are actually feeding disinformation and lying about things on purpose, trying to stop the spread of useful knowledge rather than promote it. I have many examples from many things I've done, but in order to keep this definitely American but non-Maine focused, I will simply cite the wonderful action of the North Carolina legislature in prohibiting state planners from using any information on anticipated sea level rise in any planning that they do. The problem these guys face isn't how do I talk about sea level rise, what's the confidence in my numbers, it's that they're forbidden by law from telling people that if you build this thing on the coast, it's going to be underwater in 10 years. Now, whose interests are being served there, you might ask. You would probably get the answer. Process prescription, complicated, but I think a shift for many of us of going from the notion that the business we're in is knowing things, to the business we're in is learning about things. A very famous physicist once said that the business of science was not to reject hypotheses or this or that. It was to make mistakes at the fastest possible rate and the least possible cost. That is, to move from trying out a lot of things, acknowledging most of them wouldn't work, and moving on to the next. Most of our research labs, most of our universities, most of our tenure and promotion procedures simply do not work that way. And yet, we build them, we can change them. So why aren't we changing them? Challenge, how can we, in essence, move into this adaptive management realm? Okay, the last piece of venture, since those were so easy. Understanding, many of us went into science and engineering because politics was too scary or nasty or mean, and we knew that all scientists and engineers were nice, so it would be okay. And what it does is mean that there is a very strong technocratic bias. Maybe that's an oxymoron. To what we do. We're involved in just the facts. Okay? You put them on the table, and if the state legislator says you can't consider them, that's their problem, not yours. Well, the fact is that if we're doing science that matters, and certainly in sustainable development it matters, it's about whether our kids have a future or not, almost all the knowledge we foster into that situation is born political. That is, it's going to be a chip in the greatest redistribution agenda the world has ever seen. Sustainable development at its core is a redistribution agenda. It's saying, are we benefiting in the present at the cost of future generations? And if so, too much? Should we change that? It's saying, are we benefiting here by shipping our dirty industry overseas? If so, should we change that? Facts brought onto that table are weapons in the most intense political arguments you can imagine. And so we, the chickens bringing the technical bits to the table, should hardly be surprised when we're attacked, not because our p-values were wrong, but because people just don't like the political implications of the facts that we're bringing to the table. They suspect we may be shilling for the enemy, whoever their particular enemy is. And we see this happening over and over again. We see it in, I read a little bit about forest certification, obviously a purely technical issue here in Maine. We should just want the best certification scheme. And I see people are having almost up to duels at sunrise over which certification technical scheme is best. It's obviously an issue of which benefits whom. And one could go on and on with the list. What we need to be doing, I would say, is even in the most obscure and theoretical sciences, is convincing our folks, ourselves, that if we want to play in the real world, we need to be reflexive about the power implications, about the taking sides involved. The minute we pick to study this problem rather than that problem, the minute we pick to take this evidence as definitive rather than that one, and certainly when we pick, as we often have to, whose case are we going to advocate for and who we aren't. That is the world we are in. It's not the world we're trained for. It may not have been what we went into science and technology looking for, but it's a world we're in, and it's a world that we do not get equipped to cope with in even a remotely professional and moral way without just, you know, having horrible sleepless nights and wondering what you've done wrong and so on. We ought to be able to do a little better than that. I think the crucial role for universities, even in this country, certainly around much of the developing world, is one needs safe spaces in which scientists and engineers can actually do the work that through all this other collaborative stuff and so on, they have judged to be as close as they can contribute to the public interest without fear that they are going to be sacked or have their careers terminated or never be given a grant again or kill their tenure possibilities. Can the Maine Center for Sustainable Solutions be that? Too early to tell, but that's the challenge we've got out there. Around much of the rest of the world, these are often literally safe spaces. They are where some of the international agricultural research system institutes co-appoint
really quite brilliant researchers technically working for the government in the countries they serve. What they end up doing is providing a place that the research results those folks discover that are not consistent with government policy can be passed on to their colleagues and come out of the research institute instead of out of the government scientists. It's mundane, but it matters hugely. And this safe space provision is, I think, what we've got to recognize that science in action is about. So how do we do all this? We try to accomplish all this stuff. People who have heard me talk before know that at this stage I would usually close off with an argument which is dear to my heart. It's where a lot of my own research sits. And it's about the what I and my colleagues have called the critical role of boundary work. That is, of individuals and institutions who are willing to live a good part of their life in the uncomfortable interstices between bench researchers and people on the front lines of development, whether that's families or corporations or government leaders, to work back and forth trying to get these conversations going, trying to push for adaptive, error-prone approaches rather than fixed, locked in stone ones, and so on down my list. And what we find is that these folks that I have called boundary spanners, both organizationally, and we've had some, the Office of Naval Research was in U.S. history a classic one of these that spent its entire career connecting boat drivers with hydrodynamicists at Columbia University and the like to amazing results. It's what many of the international agricultural and health research institutes do. The weird thing is these are entirely vulnerable positions. There's no organization chart I've ever seen that has a position for boundary spanners on it. You're not quite liked by people on either side because you're neither quite the techie or quite the hardline political or business leader. You're always the first to go, every institution I've ever seen, when budgets get tight because they say, well, geez, we don't really need that. That's a luxury. And yet, in case after case after case, when you finally go through all the data and the interviews, turns out, as people point out, usually this single person, sometimes this institution supporting a person, that was instrumental in getting the various sides together, natural scientists and social scientists, business leaders and technical people, competing sides in a political debate, the boundary spanners matter. So the reason I'm not ending it that way is because, of course, in preparation for this thing, I read not only Senator Mitchell's World on Fire, which I had known as a mere child, but also his subsequent work, and was attracted more and more to his descriptions of what he and even more others have called the role of shuttle diplomacy, the essential character of people who are willing to spend immense amounts of their time, energy, health, credibility, doing the hard work of moving back between people whose natural tendency isn't to listen to one another, to talk with instead of at one another, to look for cooperative or joint solutions, and to help them find those partnerships for themselves. That, which I call boundary spanning, but I think I will henceforth call shuttle diplomacy role, I think is really where many of us with ambitions to be techies who matter end up finding ourselves. We are trying to make good things happen, and it turns out that we have to do that by living in a bunch of different worlds and universes that we only partly understand. We're sort of like Molière's Bourgeois Gentilhomme, in that we find we've been speaking prose all our lives. The name of the prose is shuttle diplomacy. It's time we turn over the podium to learn from the master, which I very much look forward to. Thank you, Senator Mitchell.
I admire and appreciate Bill Clark's career-long effort to mobilize scientists, decision makers, and others in the increasingly urgent search for solutions to problems at the intersection of the environment and the economy. We're very grateful to Bill coming up here from Boston to speak to us, but I told him that there is a long history of relationship between Maine and Massachusetts, much of which many people don't fully comprehend. For example, he, like others from Boston, think that Maine used to be part of Massachusetts. We, of course, know better. Massachusetts used to be part of Maine. And once they achieved a little maturity, we were pleased to set them off on their own. And we're proud of what they have accomplished since they've been independent. So please give our best regards to the former colonists in Boston when you return. In addition to history, there's built up in Maine a long lore of humor about Maine and Massachusetts. And so I'd like, in your honor, Bill, I'd like to tell a couple of stories about that. The first one is true, the second one is not. I have a home on Mount Desert Island, and some years ago, it seemed like a long time ago, but it wasn't when we still had payphones, I went to the Jordan Pond House in Acadia National Park, and I was with a friend, and we were to meet a third friend there for lunch. The third friend didn't show up, so we went out to call him up on a payphone. There were two levels there, for those who've been to the Jordan Pond House, and there used to be a payphone in each level. And at the main level, there was a guy standing at the payphone. He had a card with a lot of numbers on top of it, and he was pouring quarters into it, not getting a good result, and he was cussing and yelling. His wife was standing there, and it became clear that he was from Boston because with a lot of expletive-filled sentences, he was deriding the culture of this backwards area where even the payphones didn't work. And the line got a little bit longer, and we waited while this tirade continued, anti-Maine, sort of. And then the guy behind me tapped me on the shoulder, and he said, "Excuse me, are you Senator Mitchell?" I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "Oh," he said, "are you here on vacation?" I said, "Yeah, just taking a couple of days off at Acadia." So to make conversation, I said, "Are you here on vacation too?" He said, "No, I'm working." I said, "What do you do?" He said, "Well, I'm a telephone repairman." Took a while for that to register with me. And he said, "When that guy from Boston runs out of quarters, I'm going to fix that phone." And he said it kind of in a conspiratorial voice. He said, "Senator," he said, "if I was you, I'd go downstairs." He said, "because they got a payphone there, and I know it's working because I just fixed it." I went downstairs and made my call, and he managed to get to fix that one. Now, one other story. This has to do specifically with Cambridge and Harvard. Back in the Depression, a couple of young guys graduated from Harvard, and of course they had a Harvard degree, but jobs were tough, so they couldn't find work. They're very smart guys, so they hit on making a living by making counterfeit $20 bills. They had an old machine that they fixed up that cranked out $20 bills, and they had a pretty nice living. And one day the machine malfunctioned, and it produced a group of $18 bills. So one of them said, "Well, we can't pass these." He said, "We got to throw these away." The other guy said, no. He said, "Look, I go up to Maine in the summer. There are a bunch of yokels up there, and there's an old guy who runs a county store. He doesn't know any better. Give me those $18 bills. I'll pass them up there." So he came up to Maine a couple months later, went to the general store, and the old timer was behind the counter. And fancy Harvard guy from Cambridge committee said, "Say, old timer," he said, "you think you could break an $18 bill?" The old guy looked at him. He said, "Sure, no problem." He said, "What do you want, 2 nines or 3 sixes?" So remember that, Bill. Well, let me say a few serious words. Beginning at a very young age, I and my brothers and my sister experienced firsthand the challenges of reconciling economic development and environmental protection. We grew up in Waterville, directly on the banks of the Kennebec River, which then was the source of power for some of the textile mills in which my mother worked. It was also the source of enormous pollution. I can remember as a small boy standing directly on the riverbank, smelling the foul odor, feeling the sting in my eyes from the chemicals discharged from textile, paper mills, and other industrial facilities. Later, I gained a deeper appreciation for this tension when, in my late 20s, I joined the Senate staff of the greatest environmental legislator in American history, Maine's own Ed Muskie. He grew up in Rumford on the banks of the Androscoggin River and also with a paper mill. And so Ed Muskie knew all about society's never-ending struggle to strike an effective balance between the critical need for jobs, the equally important need for clean air and clean water. As Bill discussed earlier, and as we all know, these tensions are at the heart of the challenge of sustainable development. That development seeks to improve human well-being while protecting our planet's life support systems. In pursuing sustainable development, we need to focus not only on the way we want the world to work today, but also on the world we want to leave for future generations. How can we make decisions that will produce a strong economy now with thriving communities and a healthy environment, and at the same time ensure that future generations have more opportunities, not fewer, as a consequence of our actions? Now, many decades after I began working for Ed Muskie, I often reflect on the progress we've made, the challenges that lie ahead, and what we've learned along the way. When I was in the Senate, I learned that science can play a central role in tackling difficult problems like acid rain. Scientific research is important because it can help us understand the causes and consequences of these problems and also potential options and the consequences of those options. As Bill emphasized, there's no guarantee that scientific knowledge will lead to effective social action. And I confess that I'm often deeply dismayed to hear and read public statements by national elected officials who engage in what can only be called the denial of science, an effort to disregard or discredit scientists and scientific discovery to protect political positions and long-held but demonstrably wrong views. We need to examine the barriers that impede our efforts to link knowledge with action and to do our best to find and implement strategies to permit meaningful change. Bill used the word shuttle diplomacy. I've spent a lot of time working that way, whether dealing with problems as Senate Majority Leader, in conflict resolution in Northern Ireland or the Middle East, or right here in Maine. I tried hard to understand and overcome the barriers that arise in situations where the solution requires many individuals and institutions with different and competing views to find a way to work together. This requires an extraordinary commitment to listening. Listening to the strong and deeply held views of men and women, to understand their real concerns, their true objections, and to try to find common ground. It also requires a lot of patience. Sometimes you have to ignore the naysayers. For example, just 4 days before we reached the peace agreement in Northern Ireland, after decades of conflict and years of negotiation, a poll was published in which 83% of the public said there was no chance of ever reaching an agreement. rather than giving up, that caused us to redouble our efforts. And 4 days later, we reached an agreement. I've been particularly gratified to learn that many of the students and the faculty connected with the Mitchell Center and its precursor, the Sustainability Solutions Initiative, are developing their own skills in shuttle diplomacy, demonstrating a commitment to listen to all sides, to gain a deeper understanding of the concerns and goals of all of the stakeholders. They're trying to ensure that their work is open and their processes transparent. They're gaining respect by giving it. To be sure, they're also learning firsthand that the road to solutions is often long and winding, and that persistence is essential to success. In a larger sense, the ethos of their work reflects one of my deepest beliefs, the importance of public service. The many faculty and students involved in the Mitchell Center have committed themselves to a goal larger than their individual lives, the goal of helping to build a better world, starting right here in our own communities, in our own state. They're helping to create a cadre of educated citizens, flexible thinkers, solutions-oriented scholars who will be prepared to respond to the challenges of the future. Their work serves as a beacon for other colleges and other universities, all of whom want to try to help society chart a more sustainable path. I believe the long-term rewards of such work significantly outweigh the difficulties involved. And to all of these scholars, students, graduate degree, those seeking higher degrees, faculty, everyone, a real thank you, not just from me, but from all here and from those in the future who will not know of your efforts, but who will benefit from them. By articulating a common vision, by building partnerships, by focusing on the needs of others, and listening to and respecting others, in particular those with whom you disagree, you're helping to create a brighter future for Maine, for our nation, and for the world. Thank you all very much.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on MPBN Radio. Today's speaker was William Clark, the Harvey Brooks Professor of International Science, Public Policy, and Human Development at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He spoke recently at the Hauck Auditorium at the University of Maine in Orono for the 2014 Senator George J. Mitchell Lecture on Sustainability. If you missed all or part of this program, you can listen to it again at any time by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcasts to access the program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Charles Beck is the executive producer for Speaking in Maine. For MPBN Radio and Speaking in Maine, I'm Jonathan Woodward.